accession number 20457, rail 17.
Brigadier Randall, rail 17. You were saying that the Japanese on point 900 had the standard equipment and gear.
Yeah, it's a long time, I can't remember. My recollection is that they were infantry, but they weren't particularly good infantry. They certainly hadn't dug a sort of proper Japanese position at all. Whether they had been sent out hurriedly by their commander to guard against our sort of fast right wing flank against there, I don't know. I got the feeling that they hadn't been there very long, and that they certainly hadn't dug themselves in. But then they were all out. They seemed to be all out in the open, really, so that they weren't. We weren't up against in terms of quality. They weren't really very good.
Did you suffer any casualties apart from the man you mentioned?
I think I had one other casualty. Yes. Well, I did, because I remember now. I can see it now. This Naik Hassan, came. One of chaps used to wear grenades tucked into their belts, so easy use. And I think some shot hit this chap grenade and exploded it. So he lost a chap there. And I can see him now saying, "Oh my section, I've lost one of my best men." But I think I had very light casualties, I think. Two or three at the very most.
Was this the first occasion on which you'd encountered a possibility of Japanese surrendering? Had you ever taken prisoners? Had you taken prisoners before, or had the chance of taking them before?
Just about, yes. I'm trying to think back to the fighting at Mactilla. I think on the way to Mactilla, after crossing the way, I think on the way to Mactilla, we did run into a Jap supply depot. I think they'd surrendered, yes. But this was about the first indication that the Japanese sort of a stoicism, fighting to the end, was beginning to crumble.
Did you have any sort of intelligence about the state of morale in the Japanese army?
I mean, we were the source of the intelligence, really, rather than the other way around.
What happened then after this fight on point
900? Well, then we moved into Piabwe, a dug position, and at that time, 17 Div went into reserve.
Yes.
And the 5th Indian Division was pushed on through.
Did you see anything of them as they passed through?
I don't remember it really, no, because we were stuck again on some hill. We were stuck near some bloody awful tannery. A tannery is bad enough in England, but in the heat of Burma, the smell of that decomposing is awful. No, we didn't. And so for about, I can't remember now, I suppose about a fortnight or so, we just moved along. The 5th Indian Division went through, captured Tonggu. And then somewhere about halfway between Tonggu and Pegu, we then leapfrogged through.
What was the rate of advance at this stage?
I think they were moving about 20, 30 miles a day. I mean, there wasn't much. I don't think there was a great deal of. I think there was a little bit of fighting at Tonggu. But we got the whip out in no uncertain fashion. I mean, we had to. It was quite clear to everybody that we had to get Rangoon. Otherwise, the chances of getting any rations was going to be that sort of thing. I mean, on a line of communication which stretched back nearly 1,000 miles. And even with the amount, and knowing that in the monsoon, that air operations are restricted, the whip was rarely out.
Did you have good roads?
Well, the main road down wasn't bad, actually. Well, we seemed we just sort of trundle along, really. I mean, because we were right behind the fifth of it. Until we got near Pegu, then we took over. The 17th Union took over. And we had to, we were in the lead, and we ran up against some quite tough Japs at Pegu, and I had to put in an attack there with me, with A Company on my right, and I had a bad day there.
What happened?
Well, we got onto the hill, but we simply couldn't fight through it.
It was another hill position then.
It was a sort of hill position,
yes.
in fairly pretty thick stuff.
Thick.
Once I couldn't get forward because the Japanese had got medium machine guns and I think a 75mm dug in an enfilade. And we were, they had quite a lot of mortars. My leading platoon commander was killed. Well, he died of wounds. He was dragged back, and I had this extraordinary, stupid order in those days that these morphine things that you jab into a chap, they could only be held by the company commander. So instead of doing my job, I was sticking morphine into chaps to stop them screaming their heads off. Disturbing the morale of other people. I mean, it was quite. I suppose they were so frightened that anybody else other than an officer would become a junkie himself. But yeah, that was pretty stupid. Anyway, we couldn't give. And then I had a lot of mortar fire in battalion in company headquarters. My FOO was killed. My company officer was wounded. Because we were so. On this hilly feature, it wasn't even the 25 pounders couldn't get crest clearance with any safety and hit the Japs. Battalion and mortar did quite a bit. Anyway, I simply couldn't get forward at all.
It was just too much fire coming back, was there, from the Japanese?
Too much fire coming back, and this enfilade fire.
Yes.
The Japanese had dug it well, it was sort of a semi reverse slope position, and as soon as you get anywhere near it, couldn't get our tanks up because it was too thick. We couldn't deal with that one because a covering position was covering fire. So...
Was the top itself clear? Had they cleared?
No, it was all thick.
It was all thick.
Yeah, it till you got just over the crest.
Yes.
And then they cleared it sufficiently, so any advance forward was taken by these when we eventually captured it, I mean, the machine gun was right dug in under logs and things like that with just this key, critical arc of fire. Then came nightfall, and the Japanese started to put in a counterattack. They had some tanks. My FOO was killed, so I had to... but it was the only time I had the whole... For about 10 minutes, I had the whole of the Corps artillery firing in front of my company. I think that was something like 4 field regiments, a medium regiment, and a troop of 9.2 heavies.
That would be a very formidable range of fire.
My God, it was half a crumb, that one. Yeah, it was quite nice. It was quite nice sitting there, hearing this bloody lot coming over. And I think that broke up. The Japanese counterattack. I mean, it was a hell of a way to fire. I mean, it may have been small fry for Northwest Europe, but to have that weight of artillery on a front of about 200 yards was quite something. Anyway, I think this convinced the Japs that they were never going to re-cake it.
So had you made some progress into their position?
Oh, I got somewhere, but I just couldn't carry on through. Yeah. And the brigade plan was next morning that another company would attack through me. But at first light, my leading platoon commander sent out patrols, and they found the Japs had pushed off in the night. Mm. So that was that.
How did you detect this Japanese counterattack starting then?
Well, we could hear tanks revving up.
Yes.
My forward platoons, they could see sort of jet movement and stuff.
Do you have any idea what sort of strength this attack, counterattack was going
to
be?
I don't know. We did find a few tanks.
Any idea of the overall strength of the Jats on that feature that you were trying to take?
I don't know. I suspect it was probably a Japanese battalion there. The A Company on my right had managed to get up, and they didn't seem to be able to. I'm not quite sure why they didn't swing round right-handed, but why they didn't come round right. But they didn't have quite such a bad time as I did.
When you got up there the next morning after the Japanese had gone, you said you found some tanks up there. What sort of tanks were they?
Well, they were. I can't remember. They're funny little Japanese tanks. I think I only saw one, really. They had a round sort of turret. I mean, they weren't sort of. Japanese tanks were never very modern, were they? I can't remember now what it was. It was just a sort of a small. I think it was a three-man tank with a. I think it had a medium machine gun on it. Anyway, I mean, I don't think it would have actually managed to get through the trees anyway. So, but at the same time, it was slightly after heavy days fighting. It was a bit alarming to think that they might.
When you called down the core artillery, how did you arrange that? What was the procedure by which you got the core artillery firing?
Well,
for you,
as you know, in every position, you always have your DF tasks and your DF SOS. I think there was a sergeant who stayed on with FO. Anyway, I had registered this DF SOS, and I called on the radio for the code word. Battalion mortar officer had been with me most of the day, and he was acting as my sort of fire support officer, but he got back to battalion headquarters. I certainly got on the radio and said, look, I think the Japs are counterattacking, and the sound of tanks. Can you, whatever the code word was, and down it came.
How long elapsed between your giving the code word and the...
Oh, pretty quick.
...time on target?
Pretty quick.
And how long did it go on for?
I think it went on for about 3 or 4 minutes, actually.
What sort of safety margin did you have? How far ahead
of... Well, this is the thing that slightly worried me, actually, because of this crest clearance, actually. Well, the air bins about... I was a bit worried about it. I mean, as you know, 25 pounders were gun howitzers. You could fire on the lower register or the higher register, but it was the medium guns. And, of course, the 9.2s, you could hear that coming over, like a huge, great sort of dustbin coming over. It was quite a most tremendous crump. But I think that they were further out. But, I mean, I think it was the morale effect on the jet. They must have realised that they're up against simply massive artillery, and there was no way they were going to sort of survive there.
You said that they had a field gun dug in on the position.
I think they had a 75mm, yes. Yeah.
Did they have any other heavy fire support?
No, they had a lot of mortars. Mm. This was, and they mortared. We've got all this awful business of the mortar bomb would hit the trees and the fragments would come down. So I had quite a hairy time. That's when my FOO was killed, and my company officer Tony Davis was wounded. He had a bit of fragment through his throat here, and I was taking care of quite a lot of mortar care. This was the thing that was being rather troublesome.
What? How was this attack organised? The was it a set piece attack?
Oh, it was, yes. I mean, we moved. I say I was on the left, and then A Company on the right, and then I think. Well, I mean, the chap was calling A Company, is still alive, still a chum of mine. He was talking about it one day. He said, because I remember that day, he said, I got off easy. You had a bloody awful day. I don't really know, quite know. He said he didn't have. He didn't have much of a time. The CO. It was a proper coordinated battalion attack.
What formation did you employ on that occasion? Going through.
Well, again, the standard sort
two
of two arm. But it was very difficult, really, to. It was so thick to have sort of specific objectives.
How far did they have to advance? You know, from
we advanced, I suppose, about half a mile, I suppose, or something like that. I'm a bit vague about the about some of the detail now.
You were saying the next morning they'd gone, they'd abandoned their position during the night.
Well, then also at the same time, the Japanese blew the big bridge over the Paegu River, much to the, and that 17 div were all set to there. To storm down the last bit into Rangoon and be the victors of Rangoon, but it was such a major obstacle that in fact, we never did get to Rangoon. We were held back on the Paegu River, and then that amphibious air business came in and captured Rangoon. Well, they didn't have to, I mean, they just walked in. The Japanese really pulled right out. They didn't pull, when they left Paegu, they went eastward, not southward. But 17 they were a bit frustrated. We couldn't get across the river, and then just I remember we had VE Day. There.
I was going to ask you about whether you were aware of developments in the Mediterranean theatre and in Europe while you were.
Well, we did get sort of news bulletins from time. We were pretty much aware, you know, that things are going pretty well, which. Was heartening because we said, well, there'll be a lot more of everything coming out this way. That was our slightly selfish attitude. So the division stayed in Paegu then.
What was Paegu like as a place?
Well, of course, I'd been there in 1942. It was a. I don't really remember very much about it, really. In fact, I think we didn't stay there very long. We went back to a place called Nongdabin, which is about 10 miles northeast. Yeah, that's right. We stayed about 3 or 4 days. We had VE Day in Paegu. I don't remember very much about it. The monsoon was just starting. It started where we were there. It must have been about the 4th or 5th of May. And then we went to this place, Nongdabin, which had some of the best Burma cheroots, I seem to remember. We all smoked these filthy rank things. But then the monsoon had started then. Certainly in Nongdabin, by the middle of May, the monsoon was on.
What did you do with yourselves while that was while you were waiting and the monsoon was?
Well, then we moved after that. The division was strung up, really, from Nongdabin northwards through a place called Penmegon, quite a long way north. The division was strung out, rather like a sort of like guns in a partridge shoot, because the pilot realized that the whole of the 28th Japanese Army, which was stuck in the Arakan and west of the Irrawaddy, was going to have to try and escape. So therefore, next 2 months, we were in well-dug, well-fire-supported positions dealing with this Japanese breakout.
Did they assault your area?
A big one?
Did they assault your...
Yes, once or twice they did. At a place called Chugtada, We were well dug in. We had massive artillery support. Mm. We had a machine gun battalion join the division. So, I mean, I had a platoon of Vickers guns supporting my company.
Did you dig the same sort of experimental sessions you'd done before?
No, I didn't there. Well, because the monsoon had come on, you see. You couldn't really dig. It was a question, really, largely of sort of sandbags and that sort of thing. Well, if you could get up under high ground, you could, but a field, paradoxically, in this case, the we knew the Japanese would probably be in low morale, so fields of fire were rather more important than the camouflage. So, the Japanese came through. We killed countless Japanese, and then they did start to surrender then. Mm. I did take one prisoner at Pago, too, who came in and surrendered, actually.
Well, he came in to you, rather than you finding him.
He came
in
to me, yeah.
Mm. What was he like? What impression did you get of him?
He seemed to be he a strange sort of chap, but he just came in, he just sort of walked in with his hands up, and he was quite well nourished, and I thought it was quite important then to get him back to battalion headquarters or somewhere interrogated, but I wanted to blindfold him in case he did a bunk or something, so I remember. And he thought we were blindfolding him to shoot him, so he put up quite a struggle, poor chap. It's a strange thing, really. One moment you're hating the player, and then next moment you feel a bit sorry for the poor bugger. Anyway, we threw him to the ground and tied him up and led him off, and he got baptized. And I think a brigade headquarters sent down a Japanese-speaking chap, and they tried to find out. I mean, what we wanted was hot intelligence about what the Japs were doing on my particular front. But then later on, during this, what they called the Battle of the Breakthrough, the Japanese then, of course, were in an appalling condition. I've never seen people in such sort of degradation, really. Because they were short of rations, it's awful rain, and they really weren't. So the sort of attacks they put in were pretty hard, pretty half-hearted. And we were in well-sighted positions with any amount of mortar, ammunition, gun. You only had to just go on the blower and give the code name, and you got. So it was a pretty uneven contest, really.
You said that the attacks were half-hearted. Were they using their standard tactics and just not pushing?
Well, I think most of them were really diversionary attacks.
Oh.
I mean, I don't think they ever. They didn't put in an attack to try and, my impression was, to capture our positions, but to divert our attentions so that in the gaps between, that they could get through. Their aim was to get through our sort of line of guns and get down to the Sitang, across the Sitang, into what was then still Japanese-held Burma. So that they weren't. We compared with the sort of assaults we got in 42 and 44, it was pretty half-hearted stuff.
Did any of them manage to make any progress or get through?
They did, but I don't know what the figure. I mean, they did get through because it's practically impossible at night and pouring rain to stop small parties of people getting through. I mean, we didn't have a sort of wire fence from north to south. Mm. But they could only have been sort of small, disjointed parties. And, of course, they did have very heavy casualties from disease as well as... And we were finding Japs lying out in the mud. I mean, I remember going out... I went out on patrol myself. I did occasionally go out on patrol, four-man patrol, just to show the boys that wasn't... And I remember we found, I thought it was a dead pig at first lying in this ditch, and then I realised it was a dead Jap, not dead, I mean a dying Jap. So we gave him the coup de grace with a bayonet. That's all we could do. We couldn't carry the chap, and we felt that a quick death with a bayonet was probably better than leaving him to rot there. But they were in a terrible condition.
Why was that? Was it the starvation that had reduced them?
Well, you see, their whole administrative system had broken down. I mean, they'd had to they'd had to cross from the Arakan Yomas. They had to get across the Irrawaddy, and there was a line, there was a sort of picket line of the 7th Indian, 20th Indian, down the Irrawaddy Valley. Then they had to get through the Pegu Yomas, and then there were 17 divs. I mean, they'd had to come several couple of hundred miles, I suppose, but virtually what they could carry with them, what they could get on from the country. And by this time, the Burmese had changed sides again and were, most of them, at, under Aung San, were on our side and were harrying them.
Was there much to be got from the country?
Oh, it always is in Burma, yes. I mean, there's always rice everywhere yes. It's not like the desert or somewhere. No, they could, but I mean, it was pretty rude, just sort of subsistence. They must have got into villages and places and managed to get rice, but then they were being harried by us all the time. Another time I was sent out to... We'd had some new mortars. I can't remember what they were. They weren't 4.2. They were some big experimental mortar. And some military genius said, well, how are we going to carry these? We're going to use elephants. So I was sent to... They said, right, well, my company would do it. And we'd go out to an operational position on the exit for the Pegu Yomas, but with these mortars. And now, the funny thing is that an elephant can't carry a great weight on its back. It can't carry very much more than a big mule. It can pull an enormous weight. But no, these mortars arrived. We had no proper sort of... So we had to improvise sort of harness for them. And off I went with these mortars and these elephants. Well, an elephant... We camouflaged our positions. We had to have the elephants there. But the trouble was, the elephants eat a vast amount of vegetation, and they were eating all our camouflage. And then they defecate an enormous amount every day, huge. And the Indian soldier doesn't like dealing with excrement of any sort from a religious point of view. So the poor old company sweeper, he was having a hell of a job. Anyway, it was a boring time. Could be all our camouflage being eaten. There were piles of elephant dung. And then we tried firing these mortars. And we had always with mortars, when you have what's called a bedding in round. You fire a couple of rounds to bed the base plate in. But the ground was so soft, they fired this thing, it went about 2 feet into the mud. And the shot, I was up forward to observe the line, observe the fire with this gunner officer who was experimenting. And it actually landed behind us, between us and the mortar. So it wasn't a great success. Then fortunately a company of the 10th Gurkhas arrived, commanded by a chum of mine who lives down here, or did live down here, and I've never been so glad to hand over anything as those bloody elephants.
How do you camouflage the elephants? That's the other question.
A bit fun?
How do you camouflage the elephants?
Well, exactly. There's nothing you could do about them.
How many of them did you have?
I think we had about four, and a baby. One of them was a cow elephant, and she had her babe with her. I mean, the whole thing was one of these sort of bright ideas that some staff officer had got and never really sat down and thought it out. And we were the sort of thing. I mean, looking back, it was an amusing and hilarious incident, really.
Who actually handled the elephants day to day and looked after them?
Well, they seemed to have the sort of mahout chaps.
Well,
I mean, as you
them.
Know, the Asian or the Burmese elephant is. I mean, I think these had been used for logging. Therefore, they were to some extent sort of trained elephants, but they hadn't been trained to carry vast loads on their backs.
Did you have the mortars carried on pack?
Well, we did improvise some sort of thing, but the elephants didn't like it. I mean, those elephants, they were trained to pull
with
heavy logs. They'd never been accustomed to having other any very great heavy loads on their back.